of sales will account for 80% of profits. And even more important than that, 20% of customers will account for 80% of profits.
If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, value saving time as much as spending it. Make room to find some balance when you schedule out your day. You deserve a meaningful time slot. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on.
Benjamin, I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hand him on, I whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Kate Nomura. She's the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden. She's here to talk about Garden of Resonance, the art of June Kaneko. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Kate.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to see you, Joseph. Thank you so much.
We're standing outside Portland Japanese Garden, where the ticket booth is in front of us. There's a reflecting pond, a rectangular pond, and then rising from the middle of this on a new kind of steel platform is this huge sort of egg-shaped blue ceramic sculpture, and it's got to be 9 feet tall. Mm-hmm. It's a mixture of light blue and very dark blue, a sort of mottled pattern, and it's kind of like a tongue, I'd say, the shape. It's flat at the bottom, goes up tall, and has this beautiful oval top to it. And this is June Kaneko, you know, great Japanese-American sculptor. He's 80 years old, and tell us why the gardeners invited his work here.
Yeah, we thought it would be a really beautiful and natural fit with the garden. His works are made to be shown, many of his works are made to be shown outdoors. They're really durable, large-scale ceramic sculptures. And something we'll get into a little bit more is that June doesn't name most of his works or any of the works that we have on display here today. He really wants the public to kind of have their own impressions and reactions and feelings when they look at these works. So we were really thinking about, our focus was how they'll naturally fit into the garden and really enhance the viewer's experience of the garden.
So you thought, let's put one in the pond.
Exactly.
The biggest one you can find, really.
This is the biggest one. You're right, it's 9 feet tall. It's just super heavy and durable. It really is can be an imposing structure when you come across it. We were thinking that the surface of this piece is really subtle and interesting to look at up close and far away. It's blue, but it has a ton of variation within it. And we wanted to show it in a water setting. And many of these pieces have the theme of water running throughout them. We follow a water path up the hill, and we use blue, black, and white in the pieces to kind of show some cohesion. This piece has a reflection in the water. I'm also excited to see it. It looks beautiful in the rain. When you came earlier, there was raindrops on it. But it really seems to evoke and magnify the movement of water around this piece.
Mm-hmm. So he's based in Omaha, Nebraska. And I understand that he's there because he had this chance to use industrial size kilns, really big, 13 foot tall kilns. He's experimented with how he makes them. So he does it like a coil pot, a little row by row, slowly building these things up over months. But he also experiments with glaze. So he has like his own kind of chemistry experiments going on.
Great way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. He has that incredible freedom to do what he wants and to experiment.
Like you say, I think play and experimentation have been a huge part of his artistic process throughout his career. Even in his 80s, he's still trying new things, experimenting with scale and medium and glazes. When he was growing up in Japan, he was more of a painter and drew. But when he moved to the U.S. in his early 20s, he became exposed to the clay movements going on at the time, ceramics, and he just was pushing the envelope of what was possible. He was invited to a residency in Omaha, Nebraska, where he now lives by his now wife, Ree Kneko, who managed an artist residency program in a brickworks kiln. And during that residency, he was able to experiment with scale in a way that he never had before. And as you said, he's now based in Omaha, where he is able to own multiple factory-sized buildings that have huge kilns within them. It's also really important for him to be able to have space to store his work, because as we saw, some of them are 9 feet tall plus. Mm-hmm. And he's continues to push the boundaries of how large ceramics can go, and works in the largest kilns available in the U.S. and abroad. I think he has the largest kiln in North America. These are all built by hand using that coil technique. You know, one layer is built up. It's allowed to dry long enough for it to be strong enough to hold the next layer, since these are such large, heavy pieces mm-hmm. of clay. And it can take years just for them to dry enough to be ready to fire.
We're in the path leading up to the garden, and there's a well covered in stone, and then one of June's pieces is it's another dumpling shape, right? It's
got
a rounded top, an elongated body with a flat bottom. The top sort of third is black, and then the rest of it is white, but the black kind of streaks down in this blue pattern. The glaze is like streaked, and then the whole thing, this one is covered in raindrops for some reason,
yeah,
whereas the others aren't.
This one is also untitled. We nicknamed it a dango, which is what June Kaneko's studio also calls this rounded kind of dumpling shape. And this was another piece that we chose to show the movement of water. As you were saying, it looks like kind of like deep blue pigment is dripping or being dragged down the side of the piece. This is a technique that you'll see a lot in June's work. It shows his sense of play and experimentation. He was doing a residency, I believe, in the Netherlands, where they have a real expertise in what is a traditional Chinese technique of using deep indigo blue and white stoneware. Thank you. And he saw that they were discarding pieces that had any drips or runs, and that really excited him. And you can see that on full display in this piece, where he's intentionally let the pigment run.
Oh, okay. When you come up the stairs, you get to the tea house, and there's a big courtyard, and there's a little sculpture terrace. You've placed one right here. It's a flat circle, like shaped like a pill. And it's polka dotted, it's white with black polka dots. And like the last piece, which was in the drainage by the well, the black glaze has run downwards and stained the white in a kind of navy blue gray color. This one again is untitled. What do you tell people when they come and stare at this?
We really encourage people to just go in with an open mind and experience the art just without any preconceptions. When I look at this piece, personally, I feel a lot of joy. It looks really playful and silly to me. The polka dots just seem so whimsical. And I also like how it plays against some of the foliage in the background. The blue, black, white really like jumps forward to me with the like lush green soft background. But it feels like a nice place to rest and, I don't know, take in something new and unexpected.
Mm-hmm. When we turn 180 degrees, there are two giant heads facing each other. One has a face and one is smooth. The smooth one has a spiral ending where the nose would be, and then the other one is horizontal stripes that don't match up. They kind of alternate at the seam. You know, it's like Easter Island, two giant faces staring at each other. And you've set them up on these black tables. They kind of look like giant IKEA coffee tables. But I'm sure they were built, you know, out of steel, because these things are heavy. And then people are allowed to go in the gap between them. It's one of those more interactive pieces. I mean, they aren't hiding this behind a fence.
Yes.
People, I'm sure, are going to touch it. There's no sign saying don't touch.
It really does feel like an anchor to the whole exhibit. And people are very welcome to touch the outdoor sculptures. Inside the pavilion, we ask people not to touch those. But they are really interactive and invite you to come up close, maybe take a picture, feel how the surface feels, step back, kind of look at it amongst the context of these really angular, you know, natural looking buildings. June is known for these type of head shaped art, and we really wanted to showcase it and let people view it from all different angles. We did curate these two pieces specifically, or our curator Aki Nakanishi did. Something I really love is that each of the heads is really different because June experiments with each one. He doesn't create two that look exactly the same. So the glaze treatment, the placement of the lines, the features of the face all have differences, and I like how these two are kind of reflecting off of each other. They're looking at each other.
We're at the Upper Pond, which is by the Moon Bridge. This sort of famous curved bridge overlooking the pond. And there's a spur of land sticking out. It's grass or moss, beautiful green, fringed with rock, which is also mossy. Then you have these two, is this indigo blue or navy blue? Just beautiful, deep, dark blue shapes. One is almost a sphere and one is again that elongated dumpling shape with the curved top, and they're both, you know, reflecting the sun and sky in their crown, but then they descend into this deep dark blue. It's almost black where it reaches the ground, and I like that they're just sitting there, but they also have this effect like when someone in jeans walks by, it brings out the blue of their clothing. Or, you know, these river rocks around the edge have a kind of blueness to them that I wouldn't normally pick out, because everything else is green. I mean, it's like every shade of green and brown you could imagine. Who came up with this placement?
Our curator Aki Nakanishi did, and he worked really closely with Hugo Tori, who is our garden curator. Something I love about these pieces is how they look like they've been there for so long. They look so natural in that environment. And the gardeners did such a beautiful job of carefully placing the moss back around the pieces after we put down the heavy bases to keep them secure. And they just look like they're so gently like floating there, or just landed, or just popped up from the ground like mushrooms. I just love how all the colors around it are super saturated and pumped up. The greens seem electric. I didn't notice how blue those stones look next to it, and I really love that. And I just the reflection of the trees and sky on the top of the piece, this is the first time I've seen those reflections. It's always been rainy and they've looked kind of organic and wet. So I'm really delighting in those reflections. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this is a garden, and if you don't know the names of the plants, like me, you can kind of get a bit lost. But this gives you some focus, right, as you're walking around. How does that work when the gardener talks about placement and the artist talk about placement? What was the effect they were going for?
I think they were looking to create moments of pause and reflection. They were trying to place them in areas where it would just enhance everything around it, make everything else just like vibrate almost. We also had practical considerations. We wanted to make sure they would be safe and level for the visitors and for the artwork. But I think this piece really shows the progression of water throughout the garden. Yeah, we tried to place the pieces, especially the blue pieces, in relationship with water in some way to show that reflection and continuation of blue as you walk through all the greenery around us.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Kate Nomura. She is the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden. And she's talking about Garden of Resonance, the art of Jun Kaneko. Over at the outside the gallery, the Pavilion Gallery, there's an overlook where normally you'd look at Mount Hood, but in the middle of this gravel space is this beautiful, another elongated dumpling shape. This one is white, kind of marbled, gray and brown and white. And on one side it has a black circle where the black has run again in the blue streaks. The other side is a black rectangle where it's run below and it has a red stripe above it. And the thing I like about it is it reminds me of the movie Arrival, where this spaceship sort of lands, sort of hovers over Earth, and nobody knows what it is or even where the door is, and they just stand there looking at it for a long time. This is my favorite piece. And it's, again, you know, it's right in the middle of everything. You could sort of lean on it, I guess, if you wanted. It's so approachable. What was it like putting it in?
It was a lot of fun putting it in. It took quite a team effort. I think we had a crew of 7 people for this one piece, because we can't get heavy machinery into this particular area. It's very natural. There's small paths leading up to it. So it took a lot of human power to get this piece looking so natural and like it's gently resting in the space.
Oh, so you kind of wheeled it in?
Exactly.
And then stuck it on like on a metal pole?
The Kaneko Studio made a special crate for it that had wheels, so we were able to push it out here. And then they also let us use something called a gantry, which is like a large metal crane, which we assembled on site around mm-hmm. this piece, and we're able to maneuver it using that gantry.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's this high gloss finish, but with so many variations in the color of, you know, the white and the sort of beige. So Kaneko, you said, was a painter. Mm. And I think his better known work looks like he just painted on it, you know, dots, stripes, faces, he just like does whatever he wants. This is a lot more minimalist and sort of abstract, but there is a, you know, he basically paints in glaze. Yeah. Right? He takes a big paintbrush and that's how he applies his glaze.
He does, it's all hand painted. I really love this piece right outside of the pavilion, because inside of the gallery we have a lot of his smaller works and you can really see that they're made by the same artist. Some of this like themes that you see here are also replicated inside, so the dripping and pulling down of the glaze, some of the bold line work. It's a really fun piece to have right outside of all these experimental works inside.
And you said he uses a lot of masking tape to get his sharp edges and stripes and things.
He does. It's all a very handmade process where he's physically applying tape and then painting around it and then peeling it off.
Mm-hmm. You also said to build them out of clay, you know, thousands of pounds of clay, it's a physical activity. He needs his strength to like push on the object and build it up.
I was shocked to hear, I don't have that background in ceramics, but they make all of their clay on site because they use such a huge volume. So they get the raw materials, they mix it in like a cement mixer and have their like their own supply of clay that they can use because no one's working at this scale. It takes, you know, a really dedicated team of ceramicists, professional ceramicists with June, and they're physically pushing the clay and molding it and carrying it, and it's, yeah, I love how it ends. This piece, you know, ends up so smooth and refined, mm-hmm. and does feel otherworldly. But I would love to be in their studio and see them working behind mm-hmm. the scenes.
You know, with clay, like, there's always a chance this is going to explode, or the glaze will just come out all weird. So these are perfection. I mean, the finish on these and the detail of the lines, this is like, presumably the work of several experiments.
I think he takes delight in the experiments. I think I was hearing that, like, out of every one piece that comes out, you know, not exploded, and you can actually put it on display, there's dozens that just were not successful. But I think for him, that's part of the joy, and there are no two pieces that look exactly the same because he, you know, there are, if you get up really close, you can, I'm curious to see what people see as imperfections or additions. This one has like a little brownish mark on the side that is running glaze. There are pock marks in the glaze also. And I think those are all things that maybe he couldn't have planned for or couldn't do exactly the same way again, but makes the piece really special. And I think keeps him going as he's entering 60 years of being a professional artist.
Mm-hmm.
He's always trying new things.
Let's go inside.
Sounds great.
As you go in the Pavilion Gallery, there are four sort of monochrome paintings on the wall. These are acrylic paintings, large rectangular canvases, and they're just vertical stripes, but there is a lot of variation between the white and the other color, which is mostly gray and brown. The top of each canvas and bottom has solid drips of paint. So he's obviously turned the canvas upside down several times. How does he do this? How does he apply the color?
Even though these look, to me, they look like they could have been made by a machine or they look very precise, he takes a lot of care with each piece. He fills a squeeze bottle with different gradations of pigment. And then lets them drip down the side of the canvas. And then once he's got it looking in a good place, he'll flip it over. And as you, I just love seeing the drips on both sides. It really kind of throws your expectations of which side is up, which side is down, mm-hmm. and how to look at the artwork.
But these are parallel drips. He doesn't, they're not drips that start out wide and then go to a point. He sort of cuts the drip off at the bottom, and it's the same width as it is at the top. So you get this very sort of modern, like you said, it could almost be a wallpaper or machine-made image. But then there's so much variation in the texture that you just know it's, you know, hand-applied. So he was a painter, but he is a sculptor. So he made these panels that, you know, they could be paintings, but they're solid ceramic. How heavy are these things?
The ones we're looking at now are over 90 pounds. We were very careful to reinforce the wall because we don't usually have works of this size. He was experimenting with a slip cast technique for these, so they are hollow in the middle, but they're still quite sturdy, heavy mm-hmm. pieces of ceramic.
Mm-hmm. So he would have a shape like a very shallow square bowl.
Exactly.
Pour in the liquid clay, the bowl sucks the water out and it becomes a thick leathery clay, and then somehow you make a top for it because it is hollow. Do you know how?
I don't know the details of that.
But one of them has a hole in it, so you can kind of see how thick it is.
this whole, it's been really fun to see people curious about, you know, is there something hidden inside, taking a look at them.
So these are all untitled wall slabs. The one on the left end, which looks very different, is mostly black, has blue sort of stripe top and bottom, and then these fishing net type pattern of brown lines across the middle, and then within these lines there are burnished parts, sort of mother of pearl and gold. This is pretty amazing. This is glaze.
The like kind of iridescent drippings are glaze, and all of the black pigment on this piece is smoke. This is a raku fire piece, and this is really kind of pushing the limits of how large you can be raku, because you're subjecting this ceramic to extreme heat and then cooling it off quickly. So this piece was heated until it was red hot, and then put into a reduction chamber room that was filled with newspaper or wood chips. And the smoke really embedded itself into this piece. So if you look, you see like some gradations where it looks like smoke or flame running up this piece, and then some of the other black ones, and that's that raku technique. And I think they lost a lot of pieces during that process.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, they found a use for newspapers. And then the lines themselves, are they glaze?
They are.
Okay, so that's a second firing.
I'm not sure if that was done before. I think that that was put on before it was put into the burning room. So I think all the glaze work was done, and everything that we see that's black now was white at the time. So it looks totally different than when he was applying glaze.
So raku is this Japanese glazing where you allow chance to have its day with a pot or a mug, and you get this organic sort of random pattern or flame or fire or smoke shape pattern on the surface, and he's taken that here and rather subtly used it to form a black background.
And your description of the technique just shows why it's a perfect fit for his personality and artistic style, that element of chance and the unknown.
Yep, there's also glass pieces here, but at the end there are these drawings on paper in frames. They're just untitled drawings. Are these are charcoal on paper. Are these finished drawings or sketches, or what? I mean, why does he draw?
He draws because this is a more immediate way to experiment and make marks on a surface. It can take his larger sculptures literally take years to see through to completion. So he's able to test new ideas. You can see some like line work that really has a parallel to some of the works that we've seen outdoors, some of the mark making on the large ceramic pieces. And he likes very graphic lines. So he gets a very textured paper. He gets it wet so it absorbs the charcoal, like makes a really dark line. And then I think he finishes the pieces somewhat quickly, and they are finished pieces, and they're a way for him to see something that he might be testing out for one of his other medium that he works with.
So these are pretty much parallel lines and sinuous lines made with what must be very thick charcoal, like an inch wide, and then he smears them down in place, or they look like, you know, it rained on them. There's this little water pattern, but this is all kind of practice for ceramics, do you think, or it's just another expression?
I think it's another expression. I think all of his works might be a practice. They're all kind of testing an idea, testing a material, seeing what will happen if you make a mark this way or heat up the kiln to that temperature. I feel like there's a strong connection to his other works, even though these are so flat and long and two-dimensional. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the garden looks good in any weather, and then these pieces outside, they have their own kind of life in any weather, but they also play off each other. But you stress that the garden is kind of primary. The plants, this will never be a sculpture garden. It's a garden first, and these are sort of additions. temporary additions.
Yeah, absolutely. Our curator Aki was saying that he was kind of thinking about it as a garden within a garden. So within this larger art form, how can we add and kind of change perspectives without altering the real intent and feel that you get when you're in the garden?
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Sarah Kate Nomura. She's the Assistant Director of Exhibitions at Portland Japanese Garden, and she was talking about Garden of Resonance, the art of Jun Kaneko, which is on now through February 20th, 2023. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again,
Sarah
Kate. Thank
you so much.
It was
such a pleasure.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Están escuchando KBOO Portland, su estación comunitaria.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 11 de octubre del